Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. We're also happy to welcome back to our program Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is here every other month for this show. We call it Talk to the Family Doctor, and we started doing it a long time ago because we thought that people out there listening could use an opportunity to talk with somebody who deals with a wide range of health issues. In his practice, Dr. Swearingen sees people of all ages, sees grown-ups, sees kids, sees people with a wide variety of concerns and worries and problems, and he has to deal with all of them. So here on the program, he stops by, and we say, okay, well, we'll open it up. And he will do his, given the constraints that, of course, he can't see you and he can't do any palpating or anything like that, you know, he will see if he can help you out and answer your questions and maybe tell you some general things that will help. And, of course, if you have something you're really concerned about, you should pursue that with somebody who can see you. But here's a place you can start and maybe get some general sort of health information, and it's sort of wide open. So the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, that's for local listeners and callers. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point here you have questions, you can give us a call. Well, thanks very much for being here once again.
Thank you, David. Glad to be back.
Just one thing I thought we could talk just a little bit here about, and it I started thinking about it because, as I'm sure people are aware, there have been some news stories about concerns that products that have peanut in them that came from a particular processing company could be contaminated with salmonella. And now a very large number of products have been recalled. And if people are concerned about this at all, I believe that if you go to the website of the FDA,
correct,
you may find a list of all of those products. And it's surprising just, in fact, how many different sorts of things, cake, cookies, ice cream, an enormous range of products that are maybe of some concern. So again, if anybody is at all worried and you have internet access, go to the FDA website and you can find out, do you have some of this stuff on your shelf? And if you do, you know, you want to get rid of it. But I guess that made me start thinking about, well, if one indeed came across some salmonella, what sort of symptoms would you see? And could you mistake that for a more run-of-the-mill kind of, you know, stomach upset intestinal bug?
Yes. The typical, what people often refer to as the stomach flu, where they get, upset stomach, they may have some vomiting and some diarrhea. The other thing that it is confused with is food poisoning. Again, something that's been contaminated that doesn't sit well with your system. In both instances, the symptoms are usually self-limited. Within 48 hours, things should be starting to sort of settle back down, because those two illnesses are usually not something that is ongoing. And generally speaking, once your body sort of cleans itself out, you sort of reset and things get back to normal. With some of the other types of infectious diarrhea, of which Salmonella is one, those symptoms may not necessarily be self-limited, though in some instances they are. There are certainly folks who've had Salmonella, were ill, and then got better on their own. And in situations where someone would have persistent symptoms, 72 hours or more, that's probably an instance where going in and checking with your physician and perhaps doing some additional testing would be reasonable.
Hmm. And so then if you had someone who you suspected might possibly have some Salmonella, then do you start out by doing some sort of a culture to make sure that is what it is?
Correct. In terms of testing, there are a wide variety of pathogenic bacteria that could potentially cause similar-looking symptoms. And depending on what's causing it, you might choose to do something different with it. Mm-hmm. A lot depends on what you potentially came in contact with. the person who says, well, I just came back from, you know, the Far East or Africa, you know, they could have picked up who knows what, things that wouldn't necessarily be common to the United States. Somebody who says, yeah, I've been camping in the woods and drinking, you know, the water out there, or my neighbor says my well is bad. Situations where potentially food or drink has become contaminated is the most common way for people to pick up an infectious form of diarrhea, of which, again, the salmonella is simply one particular kind.
Mm. And you would treat with antibiotic once you figure out what it is?
A lot depends on the severity of the symptoms and how ill the individual is. In many instances, these will in fact turn out to be self-limited. Mm-hmm. And in certain instances, treatment simply prolongs the carrier state. It will acutely settle down some of the symptoms, but it doesn't necessarily get rid of all of the bacteria. And as such, there are specific guidelines depending on which type of bacteria you're looking at as to whether it in fact should or shouldn't be treated.
Yeah.
But some of these are not treated.
Okay. So, and I suppose, though, in terms of trying to make sure that that person doesn't get worse, I would assuming that if you're having somebody who's having a lot of vomiting and diarrhea, one of the things you worry about is that person becoming dehydrated.
And that's much more of a risk in the very, very young and the very, very old. And that's typically where the significant medical problems occur. The otherwise generally healthy, you know, adult may indeed tolerate the illness fairly well, though not pleasantly.
Yeah. Okay.
But the very young and the very old are indeed at risk for things like dehydration and abnormalities in their sodium and potassium levels and things that can really get out of whack.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. We will talk with them, starting with someone in Champaign and line one.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions, and if you have the time to address either of these, that would be helpful. What types of medical tests or evaluations would you recommend for someone in their early 40s who has no insurance at this time, so has to very carefully measure out what types of testing and examinations that she has done? And my second question is, can you address the issue of inherited colon cancer or a propensity to have multiple polyps in the colon through family history association? Thank you. I'll hang up and listen off the air.
Okay.
Two very good questions. The general recommendations for medical screening will indeed vary by age and also then obviously by gender. For a otherwise healthy woman in her 40s, the most common thing that people think about is their pap smear, which if in fact has been repeatedly normal, can be deferred to being done every 2 or 3 years. So again, that's something that has to be rushed into. Depending on family history, early mammography may be recommended. There's still some controversy as to how often in the 40s mammograms should be done. There is some concern that folks with a strong family history should probably start a little earlier. Without that family history, that initial mammogram might be delayed. A lot will relate to family history. If there's a strong history of high blood pressure, basically get your blood pressure checked a few times and find out where yours is. Same is true for diabetes in terms of family history. Any woman who had a problem with her blood sugar during pregnancy is at much higher risk for diabetes later in life and would be a reasonable thing to recheck. If there's a family history of cardiovascular disease, taking a look at where your cholesterol level is would be a reasonable thing to take a look at. Whether or not it needs to be treated is an entirely different discussion. The other thing that people frequently don't associate with their medical exams is the fact that we do periodically recommend that folks get a dental exam and an eye exam. Those are typically not done with your general medical physical, but still important to do every couple of years at least. And the other issue relates to immunizations. Adults periodically need to have their immunizations updated as well. And if those haven't been done within the last 5 to 10 years, it's something that should be considered as well. Most of the rest of the examination would be tailored to symptoms that somebody might have. So in terms of general screening, the common things that we can screen for would be included in the things that we just discussed, and also in terms of family history, the most common medical illnesses would be screened for. Specifically, the question relating to colon polyps and colon cancer screening is a very good one. Typically, that screening is recommended for men and women beginning at age 50. Now, if there is a family history of colon cancer or colon polyps occurring at an age less than 50, then the general recommendation is to start that screening earlier as well. In many instances, cancer screening is begun approximately 10 years before it showed up in a family member. So if a family member at age 50 had colon cancer, then you'd want to start your colon screening at age 40. Mm. And in most instances, polyps, which are small growths inside the colon, are the precursors to colon cancers. It's very unusual for colon cancer to just suddenly appear. It's usually something that has grown over a long period of time, usually years, and typically as a result of one of these polyps sort of going bad, as we would say. And in this particular situation, anybody who has a family history of colon cancer or multiple colon polyps may in fact inherit a tendency toward that, and they put themselves in a higher risk group for screening. If somebody says, gee, nobody's had colon cancer in my family, nobody's ever had a polyp, I have no symptoms, routinely we would say some type of colon screening beginning at age 50. Now, depending on what form of screening that you choose, and there are multiple different things that have been looked at, those tests would be repeated either in 5 or 10 years to again see if polyps have started to grow. The simplest test that's probably been around the longest is simply to check for blood in the stool. And oftentimes patients are sent home with a little kit and they're asked to collect a specimen and mail it back. And if there's no blood present, then they simply repeat that on a yearly basis. That is probably the most common mass screening, but it's probably one of the least specific. There are lots of reasons why you could potentially have blood in a specimen, but if you do have blood present, then that needs to be checked out and answered as to why. Flexible sigmoidoscopy is an endoscopy procedure looking at the lower third of the colon. For low-risk patients, this is still considered adequate screening. Colonoscopy is the same type of procedure, but looks at the entire length of the colon, and is especially recommended for individuals who are at higher risk, those who have polyps or family history of colon cancer, or somebody who has known blood in their stool and we're checking out why. The third test that is still considered acceptable is the old colon X-ray. This is probably not chosen by as many people as in the past, simply because the endoscopy procedures have gotten more comfortable. If you have an abnormality on your colon X-ray, the next step is to go get endoscopy. So in some instances, it turns out to be a two-stage procedure if you opt for that first time around. The next thing on the horizon for colon screening is a radiology procedure where they're trying to basically do a 3D reconstruction with a CT scan of your colon, which they're hoping will provide more detail than the plain colon X-ray. It will still have the same problem. If you identify something that's abnormal in there, you'll need to do the colonoscopy. But for the large number of people who don't have any abnormality, then the x-ray itself may be all that they really need to have done.
Okay. Well, I hope that that helps. Caller certainly can follow up with other questions. And anyone else who was interested can call and talk with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And whatever's on your mind, you can call us 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Piatt County, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I think maybe I speak for a lot of people who try to watch their diet and exercise and things like that. But I'm concerned about, or curious, too, about the articles that you read. Oh, say like the emphasis on green tea, or my friend who takes honey and cinnamon because she read an article and it just does, you know, everything for you, honey and cinnamon instead of, you know, sugar. And blueberries for memory and... I also read about, I think it was turmeric for cancer, you know, using turmeric as a spice. And then I've read, you know, the same thing about ginger, as a matter of fact, and garlic and onions. And you know, it seems like if you ate all these things, it would be hard. I mean, you know, they always say to eat a balanced diet.
Right.
But I am just wondering, is there any website, you know, because I know that studies can be small or large based on certain factors. Is there any website that you could check where you could see maybe a list of studies that have been done on these food, different food miracles that we're supposed to emphasize in our diets?
I'm not coming up with anything off the top of my head as to a specific website that would compare all of those. The problem, as you pointed out, is that in many instances, some of these substances have no studies whatsoever to support them. It's just a claim.
Mm-hmm.
In other instances, studies have either been very small, poorly designed, hard to draw conclusions from. It's inherently difficult to evaluate, you know, a small quantity of, you know, pick whatever one of these substances you want and say, gee, how does that offset the other, you know, 99.99% of the things that I'm putting into my body and
right.
doing over the course of, you know, decades. So it's very, very difficult. Some things have specifically been looked at to find out if they do in fact have any benefit for what they claim they're good for, and a lot of these have not been shown to be particularly useful. Now, if somebody wants to use honey and cinnamon instead of plain white sugar, that's probably not going to hurt them. Whether it will convey any additional health benefit to them, as far as I'm aware, currently that's really unknown.
Well, it's just suddenly pomegranate juices everywhere, and it's in everything, and pomegranate juice is apparently supposed to cure. I mean, I just find it interesting our willingness to suddenly change, you know, or to assume that a certain food is going to do a certain thing. So I was just wondering about research. I guess I could probably you know, try to see where the articles are published and go from that research, I guess. It just seems like a confusing, you know, people want something to help.
Well, you're exactly right, and we frequently have folks in the office, you know, asking this exact question, yet when we ask them if they're still smoking, they say yes. and I'm, you know, sometimes a little confused that, you know, why a, you know, magazine article, you know, touting cinnamon somehow is more important than, you know, the decades of data that we have about the adverse effects of smoking. So people sometimes really sort of lose sight of the forest for the trees. These little minor things, you know, again, probably aren't going to be making major changes in one's health, but the daily activities of, you know, smoking, alcohol abuse, not getting exercise, those things are known to be problems, and can be, you know, readily taken care of, but they require a whole lot more effort, unfortunately, than just, you know, picking up a supplement.
Would you generally recommend then what I've seen called the Mediterranean diet, with the emphasis on fruits and vegetables and olive oil and things like that?
Certainly, better quality oils with fewer trans fats, more fruits, more vegetables, because they come with a lower glycemic index. They have a lot more fiber, minimizing the amount of red meat. Those are very reasonable things. You know, if somebody's concerned, gee, I'm missing some trace element, a good multiple vitamin once a day would be fine. But large-scale supplementation with other things just really haven't been shown to be all that useful.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. It's probably good just to say cinnamon and turmeric and blueberries and green tea are all fine things, and have them because they're good. Don't drink a gallon of green tea every day. That probably won't really help you. I don't know if it would hurt you, but it probably won't.
Well, if it prevents you from drinking the beer, that would be fine.
Oh, okay. So. Well, every once in a while, you need a little. Oh, never mind. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. Every other month, he's here for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So if you have a health care question for yourself or someone in your family, could be a child kind of thing, too, because he does see kids in his practice as well. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One thing that maybe a lot of these things that, you know, fall under this category of functional foods that now people are talking about, I think a lot of these things broadly fall into this category we call antioxidants, that it is believed that that does have some benefits. Do you think that there is a good reason to – well, maybe I should take the step back and say, well, what exactly is an antioxidant, and then is there some reason to believe that that's a – we'd be better off if we tried to get more of those things into our diet.
Well, things that cause oxidation internally in the body are associated with inflammation in blood vessels. And this has been linked most strongly to cardiovascular disease, but there's also some studies that suggest that it has a role in cancer formation. So the general thought of decreasing the number of oxidation processes going on in the body by the use of things that are, in fact, antioxidants could be helpful. Again, the problem is that these are fairly trace substances, and it's very difficult to pick out their effect against the background of everything else that people do over the course of their lives. And so it still boils down to, the fairly common sense things that everybody has been aware of. Smoking's not good for you. Alcohol in excess is not good for you. Being terribly overweight isn't good for you. Good things for you are, in fact, regular exercise, a diet that is higher in fruits and vegetables as opposed to meats and fats. These things have been, you know, pretty well known for a long period of time, but they require some self-discipline on the part of the individual to make some good, healthy choices. I think too often, you know, we're looking for the magic pill that'll allow me to continue to do what I want to do, but not suffer any consequences.
Okay. We have some other folks to talk with. We'll go to a caller in Edgar County. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a quick question. I have a son who's going to be turning 3 in the next couple weeks, and he drinks a lot of fluid. He's always asking for water or milk or juice, and he urinates a lot, and he's not eating as much as I think he should, and we try to keep those things from him, but he's still urinating a lot. It's like he's getting out more fluid than he's getting in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm concerned about that because diabetes runs in our family, and my mother said something about it, and we weren't sure due to his age and just his general.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he seems fine,
right?
But that worries me.
All right. Checking for diabetes in a child, one of the simplest things to do, if the blood sugar is really, really high, that extra sugar ends up in the urine, which is why diabetics urinate more frequently. That extra sugar gets pulled out in the urine with more fluid. You can simply collect a urine specimen, check it for sugar. If there's any question at all about that, simply a finger stick, just a drop of blood to check the blood sugar, and that can either take the whole issue of diabetes off the table. Or, you know, obviously pursue it if it's abnormal. But it's very simple and straightforward to test for, and you know, given the family history and what you've described, would be a very reasonable thing to check.
Okay, so, it's not uncommon for children to do it. I mean, he's in there every 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. The key here will be to exclude some other medical concern as a cause for that.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Back here to caller in Urbana and line number two.
Good
Hello.
Morning.
Yeah.
I'm calling about the vaccine that has recently become available against shingles disease.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's only been available, maybe within the last couple of years.
Correct.
The reason I'm interested, I'm a 60-year-old person, and I saw a friend die, and in her dying days, she had a terrible, terrible affliction of shingles, and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. I'd like to know what are the contraindications, I think you call them, that is the people
mm-hmm.
and conditions that would argue against having the shingles vaccine, and what are the percentage chances that the vaccinated person would get shingles? And also, you may know that many health insurance programs do not cover the vaccine, so locally people who want it will probably be paying for it out of pocket. I think it's $300 or so. So I'd love to hear anything you have to say about the vaccine against shingles.
Sure.
Thank you.
You're welcome. This, as the caller pointed out correctly, is available within the last year or so. It is a vaccination with the same type of virus that causes chickenpox. The people are familiar with the name shingles. The medical name is herpes zoster. And the varicella virus in that same family is the cause of chickenpox when you're little, though most kids these days are immunized against it, so aren't likely to, as in days past, to break out with the typical chickenpox rash. But when you have chickenpox or exposed to that virus, even after your chickenpox goes away, the virus continues to reside in your body, and it actually lives in some of the nerve roots in the spine. Sometime later in life, and that can be literally any time, but it's actually much more common after the age of 60, that virus, for a number of reasons, can become reactivated, and it will travel out the nerve root that it had been living in all these years, and it produces a pattern because it follows that nerve. So there's a very clearly demarcated path that the virus has fallen that gives shingles its very characteristic appearance. In the vast majority of people who come down with shingles, it's painful, it's uncomfortable, and it fortunately goes away. In a few instances, it can be as the caller pointed out, a very miserable experience. It can be unbelievably painful, and in some cases, it doesn't go away. Even though the rash goes away, that pain in the nerve remains. And this is called postherpetic neuralgia and can be a very, very miserable experience. So they basically came up with a sort of booster vaccine against the chickenpox virus that's intended to be given to adults over the age of 60. There are really very few contraindications, other than, as the caller pointed out, perhaps the cost. The problem with new vaccinations and medical coverage is the fact that when something's brand new, it's oftentimes not covered by insurance. Once it's been out there a little while, has within the medical community been considered to now be part of the standard of care, then most insurance companies will, in fact, cover that. So we do tell people that the vaccination is available to check with their insurance company regarding coverage. But for individuals over the age of 60, it's a very reasonable way of trying to reduce your risk of having an outbreak of shingles. The percentage of improvement or the decrease in the risk is about 50%. So folks who are vaccinated will have 50% fewer outbreaks of shingles in that group as compared to another group of 60-year-olds who didn't get vaccinated. It's otherwise a very well-tolerated immunization, and I think is a very reasonable thing to consider, especially in situations where there would be any other concerns about decreased immunity. It seems that the aging process is associated with a slight decrease in the effectiveness of our immune system, but certainly certain medical conditions and certainly certain types of treatment can alter our immune response. And in those particular patients, those folks are, in fact, at higher risk for developing something like shingles.
All right. Well, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. We'll continue next talking with someone on a cell phone, line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a couple of things. One, I just wanted to say that I've been in, I came into the show about halfway through and heard you talking about the alcohol problems, the drug problems. I've been a person in recovery here in Champaign-Urbana for about 17 years, and I know clinically, it's easy to look at our choices and our things like that, but with our eating as well, how certain foods are much better for us, we can make those choices. Certain exercise, of course, is better for us, we can make that choice. But I think that to round that out a little more, I think that a lot of us who have dealt with drug and alcohol addiction and plus other things that we consider addictive feel that we have a spiritual sickness as well. And I think that we're not trying to push religion or any kind of specialized belief in a religion or anything like that, but just hoping to, I suppose advocate spirituality and growth in spirituality as being yet another part of getting your whole self and your whole body healthy. And I guess I kind of wanted to hear if you have anything to say about that. And then I do have one other quick question I want to ask.
Go ahead.
Other question is something else. So
okay. Well, your comment about spirituality is tied to our sense of psychological well-being, and it is entirely impossible to separate that from our physical well-being. We often talk about our mental health and our physical health, but in fact, there is just health. Certainly our brain and what's going on inside of it is not distinct from the rest of our body. It is simply part and parcel. We all very easily understand that when we have the flu and we have, we're feeling terrible and we have fevers and we chills and we have aches, that our physical lack of well-being at that time has a profound effect on our mood. we're usually not terribly chipper or cheerful at those particular times, and people readily acknowledge that their physical well-being has an effect on their psychological, mental, and spiritual well-being. But the reverse is also true. It's truly a two-way street, and people who are troubled by psychological, spiritual issues, it can have an impact on the choices that they make, and that can, in fact, adversely affect their physical well-being also. So they're really simply part of the whole same thing. It's in many instances easier for us to talk about the medical and the physical because it's something that we can poke and prod and measure and test. The psychological and spiritual parts of our health and well-being are much harder to objectively evaluate, but that doesn't necessarily make them any less important.
Oh, thank you. I think that's it's very well put. I did have one other question that I have been struggling with, and this one probably on a spiritual as well as I have a 7-year-old son who is struggling in his first year of grade school. Actually, he'd been through kindergarten and done fairly well through kindergarten, but in his first year of grade school, he was struggling on his behavior. So my wife and I decided to go and seek counseling and talk with a therapist and a psychologist, a psychiatrist, I think, actually. And we collectively decided that, you know, we would try him on Ritalin. And, you know, I've heard tons of horror stories about Ritalin, and I've heard tons of good stories. And I guess I just wanted to see what your take on Ritalin was. When we gave him the Ritalin, it was like a switch being thrown. He went from having problems to not having problems, seriously. I mean, it was that night and day. He's had 2 straight months of just excellent behavior marks at school, and we didn't even let his teacher in on the fact that we've given it to him. So she saw it as a light switch too. So, but I hear more and more about, you know, long-term use of Ritalin and addictive behaviors, and I being an addictive person, I guess I wanted to see what your take on Ritalin is in families with addictive behaviors.
Okay. It's a very good question. The key to a positive response to medications like Ritalin is to have a fairly good grip on the correct diagnosis. And this is not necessarily an easy thing to obtain, because again, we're dealing with issues that are sometimes hard to measure from the traditional medical standpoint. There isn't a blood test that you can do on somebody and say, gee, you need Ritalin.
All right.
So in this particular setting, there's usually no rush to medication, but if after consideration of the input from parents, from teachers, from the child themselves, there's enough data gathered that lends to a feeling that a trial of medication would be reasonable, then that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. This is in addition to all of the standard instructions about trying to stabilize the home environment and the learning environment and getting appropriate attention and making sure that there aren't learning disabilities present that need to be addressed. But a trial of medication, as you pointed out, in some instances can be quite dramatic in terms of the improvement seen. And this generally is an indicator that you're on the right track. Whether medication will be necessary for a long period of time or not, there isn't any way to predict that. And frequently, as time goes by, there are times when we will advocate a trial off medication to see how things go. Some kids seemingly, quote, outgrow their need for medication and will continue to do well. Other kids will need to continue to use it as long as they're in situations where they need the focus and the attention that is required to do well in school. And so, now, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Well, just one last little question then on that. If the child knows that he's taking it, is it feasible to let the child assume that he's still taking it when you say, you know, take them away from the drug and see if it has a, you know, as a placebo type of effect, see if it works without the drug, without letting him know it?
My personal practice has been to simply have this conversation with the parents and the child in the room and say, you know, you've done well. The question has come up as to whether you still need it or not. The two approaches are going to be either take less and taper it off, or simply say, you know, for next year, we're just going to see how things go without it and go from there.
And he's at the bare minimum of what you know, the prescription-wise anyway, so he's not taking... if we did anything, we'd take him totally off of it because he, I guess he could break the capsule in half. But I was just curious on your take on it, and I appreciate it because it's given me some good ideas. Real quick, do you have any books or anything that you know of that you direct people towards?
There are some excellent books on ADD and Ritalin usage, and I am quite sorry that I cannot remember it.
To the library.
But yes, if you check those two terms, you will come up with several, and there are a couple of good ones out there.
Okay, thank you very much.
Very good, thank you. We have about 6, 7, 8 minutes maybe left this morning in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He is here every other month, always on a Monday for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So it's your opportunity to call in and discuss whatever kind of health questions you have with him. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have some other callers here. And the next is in Urbana and line 1. Hello.
Yes, I seem to be hearing a lot about the need of vitamin D recently and a wide disparity in the supposed necessary units that should be taken.
Mm-hmm.
What is your guidance on this? I might add I'm 72 years old.
Well, then you've probably done all the right things already. Otherwise, you wouldn't have made it this far.
Well, that's good news.
So... what's come out recently are some studies that have shown an association, and this is where we really have to be careful, an association between lower levels of vitamin D and other types of illnesses, including cardiovascular disease and the onset of certain types of cancers. And there has been discussion as to, well, gee, maybe people need to get more vitamin D into their system. That's somewhat simplistic because what has not been shown yet is that a deficiency of vitamin D causes these other illnesses. There haven't been any studies yet that have shown that having people take more vitamin D actually prevents those diseases from happening. So there are things that are associated with illnesses, and there are causative factors, and they're not necessarily the same thing, and that's where the debate is right now. There is data showing an association between lower levels of vitamin D and other illnesses, but no direct cause and effect relationship has yet been established. We do know that in situations where, say, osteoporosis, where the recommendations for more vitamin D to aid calcium metabolism, to aid in bone formation, those are pretty well set. The absence of vitamin D definitely interferes with our body's ability to make bone. So we definitely know that people should be getting an adequate amount of vitamin D, and probably 1,000 international units a day is a reasonable amount to make sure that you're getting. Now, this is available by standing out in the sun for a short period of time each week, or alternatively, milk and dairy products are vitamin D fortified. Sort of fatty fishes, your salmons, the omega-3 kind of things, they also contain a lot of vitamin D. So there are other ways to supplement the amount that you get, in addition to just taking a vitamin supplement. But before everybody, you know, says, gee, I need to take a whole bunch of vitamin D to prevent X number of diseases, we really need more data before we can come to that conclusion.
Well, I'm getting a fairly good amount of green vegetables and fruits, this sort of thing. I probably get outdoors every day for a time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking one multiple-purpose vitamin pill with, I think, 500 units.
Mm-hmm.
Would I be likely getting enough from a sun exposure and diet? Or
given what you've described, I don't think that would be any problem at all.
But probably a good idea to stay with the multiple vitamin?
It's perfectly reasonable to use the multivitamin to cover your bases. And in terms of the amount that we need, most vitamins have the basic quantities that are necessary, at least until we have additional data that says, you know, certain things need to be taken in larger quantities.
Has there been any work on overdosing?
The upper limit of vitamin D keeps getting pushed upwards. We have had reports of people taking literally thousands of international units of vitamin D on a daily basis without apparent adverse effect, though it is theoretically possible to overdose on vitamins, but you would need to take quite a bit for quite a long time for that to really be a problem.
The sun exposure in the winter, of course, is a problem.
Right.
If your hands are uncovered and you're not wearing anything over your face, is this going to, in 10, 15 minutes, give you a fair dose?
You probably need more exposure than just hands and face, yes.
I see. That could be a problem during
the summer. It definitely is in our climate.
Would working in a greenhouse with plexiglass covering, would that allow enough? It's the the ultraviolet light, isn't it?
Right.
The infrared.
So no, that should not be a problem. But that kind of exposure during the winter would certainly be beneficial.
Well, thanks so much.
All right, thank you. I'll try to get one more caller here. This is someone in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to refer back to the shingles vaccine. Because I have just checked last week with Medicare, and they tell me that if you are on Medicare, your shingles vaccine with a small copayment would be covered.
Well, that's good news.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, that indeed brings me back to, I did want to ask a further question about that. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that what happens is that people get chicken pox, and then the virus that causes chicken pox, it kind of goes and hides in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And in some people, fortunately not everybody,
fortunately,
it can come back as shingles. So I think, and I remember long, long time ago when we were talking about, I think this was really before the chickenpox vaccine became widespread here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that was raised was, well, if we vaccinate people and they never get chickenpox, does that also mean that they're never going to get shingles?
No.
Ah, so there's actually some data that shows that that is not prevent will not prevent you from a later possibility of shingles.
Correct.
Okay. So then again, just who would you? The earlier caller talked about contraindications. That is there anybody you would say don't get this? Who would you recommend should think about having the shingles vaccine?
Basically, the indications for using the vaccine are anybody over the age of 60.
Oh, okay. So it's anybody who wishes and
to statistically reduce their risk of shingles.
But that's it's also not a guarantee that if you get the vaccine that you will. You're not going to say, I can guarantee you, but you can't say you're not going to get shingles, but there'll be significant reduction in your risk.
50%.
Okay. Well, right. that's pretty good. And shingles, I fortunately have not experienced this, but I've certainly heard people describing it, and it sounds like it's really unpleasant. And if you could possibly avoid it, you would want to.
Right.
I guess maybe we'll just leave it at that and say thanks very much to our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is with us every other month. It's always on a Monday for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.